Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Chapter 19 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 19. A Strange Symposium. It came upon me with something of a shock of surprise to find the scrap of paper still tacked to the oak of Thorndyke's chambers. So much had happened since I had last looked on it that it seemed to belong to another epoch of my life. I removed it thoughtfully and picked out the tack before entering, and then closing the inner door but leaving the oak open, I lit the gas and fell to pacing the room. What a wonderful episode it had been! How the whole aspect of the world had been changed in a moment by Thorndyke's revelation! At another time, curiosity would have led me to endeavor to trace back the train of reasoning by which the subtle brain of my teacher had attained this astonishing conclusion. But now my own happiness held exclusive possession of my thoughts. The image of Ruth filled the field of my mental vision. I saw her again as I had seen her in the cab with her sweet, pensive face and downcast eyes. I felt again the touch of her soft cheek and the parting kiss by the gate, so frank and simple, so intimate and final. I must have waited quite a long time, though the golden minutes sped unreckoned, for when my two colleagues arrived they tendered needless apologies. "And I suppose," said Thorndyke, "you have been wondering what I wanted you for." I had not, as a matter of fact, given the matter a moment's consideration. "We are going to call on Mr. Jellicoe," Thorndyke explained. "There is something behind this affair, and until I have ascertained what it is, the case is not complete from my point of view." "Wouldn't it have done as well tomorrow?" I asked. "It might, and then it might not. There is an old saying as to catching a weasel asleep. Mr. Jellicoe is a somewhat wide-awake person, and I think it best to introduce him to Inspector Badger at the earliest possible moment." "The meeting of a weasel and a badger suggests a sporting interview," remarked Jervis. "But you don't expect Jellicoe to give himself away, do you?" "He can hardly do that, seeing that there is nothing to give away. But I think he may make a statement. There were some exceptional circumstances, I feel sure." "How long have you known that the body was in the museum?" I asked. "About 30 or 40 seconds longer than you have, I should say."
"Do you mean," I exclaimed, "that you did not know until the negative was developed?"
"My dear fellow," he replied, "do you suppose that if I had had certain knowledge where the body was, I should have allowed that noble girl to go on dragging out a lingering agony of suspense that I could have cut short in a moment? Or that I should have made these humbugging pretenses of scientific experiments if a more dignified course had been open to me?" "As to the experiments," said Jervis, "Norbury could hardly have refused if you had taken him into your confidence." "Indeed he could, and probably would. My confidence would have involved a charge of murder against a highly respectable gentleman who was well known to him. He would probably have referred me to the police, and then what could I have done? I had plenty of suspicions, but not a single solid fact." Our discussion was here interrupted by hurried footsteps on the stairs and a thundering rat-tat on our knocker. As Jervis opened the door, Inspector Badger burst into the room in a highly excited state.
"What is all this, Dr. Thorndyke?" he asked.
"I see you've sworn an information against Mr. Jellicoe, and I have a warrant to arrest him, but before anything else is done, I think it right to tell you that we have more evidence than is generally known, pointing to a quite different quarter." "Derived from Mr. Jellicoe's information," said Thorndyke. But the fact is that I have just examined and identified the body at the British Museum, where it was deposited by Mr. Jellicoe. I don't say that he murdered John Bellingham, though that is what appearances suggest. But I do say that he will have to account for his secret disposal of the body. Inspector Badger was thunderstruck. Also, he was visibly annoyed. The salt which Mr. Jellicoe had so adroitly sprinkled on the constabulary tail appeared to develop irritating properties, for when Thorndyke had given him a brief outline of the facts, he stuck his hands in his pockets and exclaimed gloomily, "Well, I'm hanged. And to think of all the time and trouble I've spent on those damn bones! I suppose they were just a plant?" "Don't let us disparage them," said Thorndyke. "They have played a useful part. They represent the inevitable mistake that every criminal makes sooner or later. The murderer will always do a little too much. If he would only lie low and let well alone, the detectives might whistle for a clue. But it is time we are starting." "Are we all going?" asked the inspector, looking at me in particular with no very gracious recognition. "We will all come with you," said Thorndyke, "but you will naturally make the arrest in the way that seems best to you." "It's a regular procession," grumbled the inspector, but he made no more definite objection, and we started forth on our quest. The distance from the Temple to Lincoln's Inn is not great. In 5 minutes we were at the gateway in Chancery Lane, and a couple of minutes later saw us gathered round the threshold of the stately old house in New Square. "Seems to be a light in the first floor front," said Badger. "You'd better move away before I ring the bell." But the precaution was unnecessary. As the inspector advanced to the bell pull, the head was thrust out of the open window immediately above the street door. "Who are you?" inquired the owner of the head in a voice which I recognized as that of Mr. Jellicoe. "I am Inspector Badger of the Criminal Investigation Department. I wish to see Mr. Arthur Jellicoe." "Then look at me. I am Mr. Arthur Jellicoe." "I hold a warrant for your arrest, Mr. Jellicoe. You are charged with the murder of Mr. John Bellingham, whose body has been discovered in the British Museum."
"By whom?"
"By Dr. Thorndyke."
"Indeed," said Mr. Jellicoe. "Is he here?"
"Yes."
"Huh. And you wish to arrest me, I presume?"
"Yes, that is what I am here for." "Well, I will agree to surrender myself subject to certain conditions."
"I can't make any conditions, Mr. Jellicoe."
"No, I will make them and you will accept them. Otherwise you will not arrest me."
"It's no use for you to talk like that," said Badger. "If you don't let me in, I shall have to break in. And I might as well tell you," he added mendaciously, "that the house is surrounded."
"You may accept my assurance," Mr. Jellicoe replied calmly, "that you will not arrest me if you do not accept my conditions."
"Well, what are your conditions?" demanded Badger.
"I desire to make a statement," said Mr. Jellicoe.
"You can do that, but I must caution you that anything you say may be used in evidence against you."
"Naturally, but I wish to make the statement in the presence of Dr. Thorndyke, and I desire to hear a statement from him of the method of investigation by which he discovered the whereabouts of the body. That is to say, if he is willing."
"If you mean that we should mutually enlighten one another, I am very willing indeed," said Thorndyke.
"Very well. Then my conditions, Inspector, are that I shall hear Dr. Thorndyke's statement and that I shall be permitted to make a statement myself, and that until those statements are completed, with any necessary interrogation and discussion, I shall remain at liberty and shall suffer no molestation or interference of any kind. And I agree that, on the conclusion of said proceedings, I will submit without resistance to any course that you may adopt."
"I can't agree to that," said Badger.
"Can't you?" said Mr. Jellicoe coldly. And after a pause he added, "Don't be hasty. I have given you warning." There was something in Mr. Jellicoe's passionless tone that disturbed the inspector exceedingly, for he turned to Thorndyke and said in a low tone, "I wonder what his game is. He can't get away, you know."
"There are several possibilities," said Thorndyke.
Yes, said Badger, stroking his chin perplexedly. "After all, is there any objection? His statement might save trouble, and you'd be on the safe side. It would take you some time to break in."
"Well," said Mr. Jellicoe, with his hand on the window, "do you agree? Yes or no?"
"All right," said Badger sulkily. "I agree." You promise not to molest me in any way until I have quite finished?
I promise.
Mr. Jellicoe's head disappeared and the window closed. After a short pause, we heard the jar of massive bolts and the clank of a chain, and as the heavy door swung open, Mr. Jellicoe stood revealed, calm and impassive, with an old-fashioned office candlestick in his hand.
"Who are the others?" he inquired, peering out sharply through his spectacles.
"Oh, they are nothing to do with me," replied Badger.
"They are Dr. Berkeley and Dr. Jervis," said Thorndyke.
"Ha!" said Mr. Jellicoe. "Very kind and attentive of them to call. Pray come in, gentlemen. I am sure you will be interested to hear our little discussion."
He held the door open with a certain stiff courtesy, and we all entered the hall led by Inspector Badger.
He closed the door softly and preceded us up the stairs and into the apartment from the window of which he had dictated the terms of surrender. It was a fine old room, spacious, lofty, and dignified, with paneled walls and a carved mantelpiece, the central escutcheon of which bore the initials JWP with the date 1671. A large writing table stood at the farther end, and behind it was an iron safe.
"I have been expecting this visit," Mr. Jellicoe remarked tranquilly, as he placed four chairs opposite the table.
"Since when?" asked Thorndyke.
"Since last Monday evening, when I had the pleasure of seeing you conversing with my friend Dr. Berkeley at the Inner Temple Gate, and then inferred that you were retained in the case. That was a circumstance that had not been fully provided for. May I offer you gentlemen a glass of sherry?" As he spoke, he placed on the table a decanter and a tray of glasses, and looked at us interrogatively with his hand on the stopper.
"Well, I don't mind if I do, Mr. Jellicoe," said Badger, on whom the lawyer's glance had finally settled. Mr. Jellicoe filled the glass and handed it to him with a stiff bow. Then, with the decanter still in his hand, he said persuasively, "Dr. Thorndyke, pray allow me to fill you a glass."
"No, thank you," said Thorndyke, in a tone so decided that the inspector looked round at him quickly. And as Badger caught his eye, the glass which he was about to raise to his lips became suddenly arrested, and was slowly returned to the table untasted.
"I don't want to hurry you, Mr. Jellicoe," said the inspector, "but it's rather late, and I should like to get this business settled. What is it that you wish to do?"
"I desire," replied Mr. Jellicoe, "to make a detailed statement of the events that have happened, and I wish to hear from Dr. Thorndyke precisely how he arrived at his very remarkable conclusion. When this has been done, I shall be entirely at your service, and I suggest that it would be more interesting if Dr. Thorndyke would give us a statement before I furnish you with the actual facts."
"I am entirely of your opinion," said Thorndyke.
"Then in that case," said Mr. Jellicoe, "I suggest that you disregard me and address your remarks to your friends as if I were not present."
Thorndyke acquiesced with a bow, and Mr. Jellicoe, having seated himself in his elbow chair behind the table, poured himself out a glass of water, selected a cigarette from a neat silver case, lighted it deliberately, and leaned back to listen at his ease.
"My first acquaintance with this case," Thorndyke began without preamble, "was made through the medium of the daily papers about 2 years ago, and I may say that, although I had no interest in it beyond the purely academic interest of a specialist in a case that lies in his particular specialty, I considered it with deep attention. The newspaper reports contained no particulars of the relations of the parties that could furnish any hints as to the motives on the part of any of them, but merely a bare statement of the events. And this was a distinct advantage, inasmuch as it left one to consider the facts of the case without regard to motive, to balance the prima facie probabilities with an open mind. And it may surprise you to learn that those prima facie probabilities pointed from the very first to that solution which has been put to the test of experiment this evening. Hence it will be well for me to begin by giving the conclusions that I reached by reasoning from the facts set forth in the newspapers before any of the further facts came to my knowledge. From the facts as stated in the newspaper reports, it is obvious that there were four possible explanations of the disappearance. 1. The man might be alive and in hiding. This was highly improbable, for the reasons that were stated by Mr. Loram at the late hearing of the application, and for a further reason that I shall mention presently. 2. He might have died by accident or disease, and his body failed to be identified. This was even more improbable,
seeing that he carried on his person abundant means of identification, including visiting cards. 3. He might have been murdered by some stranger for the sake of his portable property. This was highly improbable for the same reason. His body could hardly have failed to be identified. These three explanations are what we may call the outside explanations. They touch none of the parties mentioned. They were all obviously improbable on general grounds, and to all of them there was one conclusive answer: the scarab which was found in Godfrey Bellingham's garden. Hence I put them aside and gave my attention to the fourth explanation. This was that the missing man had been made away with by one of the parties mentioned in the report. But since the reports mentioned three parties, it was evident that there was a choice of three hypotheses, namely, A, that John Bellingham had been made away with by Hearst, or B, by the Bellinghams, or C, by Mr. Jellicoe. Now, I have constantly impressed on my pupils that the indispensable question that must be asked at the outset of such an inquiry as this is, when was the missing person last undoubtedly seen or known to be alive? That is the question that I asked myself after reading the newspaper report, and the answer was that he was last certainly seen alive on the 14th of October, 1902, at 141 Queen Square, Bloomsbury. Of the fact that he was alive at that time and place there could be no doubt whatever, for he was seen at the same moment by two persons, both of whom were intimately acquainted with him, and one of whom, Dr. Norbury, was apparently a disinterested witness. After that date he was never seen, alive or dead, by any person who knew him and was able to identify him. It was stated that he had been seen on the 23rd of November, following by the housemaid of Mr. Hearst, but as this person was unacquainted with him, it was uncertain whether the person whom she saw was or was not John Bellingham. Hence the disappearance dated not from the 23rd of November, as everyone seems to have assumed, but from the 14th of October, and the question was not what became of John Bellingham after he entered Mr. Hearst's house, but what became of him after his interview in Queen Square. But as soon as I had decided that that interview must form the real starting point of the inquiry, a most striking set of circumstances came into view. It became obvious that if Mr. Jellicoe had had any reason for wishing to make away with John Bellingham, he had such an opportunity as seldom falls to the lot of an intending murderer. Just consider the conditions. John Bellingham was known to be setting out alone upon a journey beyond the sea. His exact destination was not stated. He was to be absent for an undetermined period, but at least 3 weeks. His disappearance would occasion no comment. His absence would lead to no inquiries, at least for several weeks, during which the murderer would have leisure quietly to dispose of the body and conceal all traces of the crime. The conditions were, from a murderer's point of view, ideal. But that was not all. During that very period of John Bellingham's absence, Mr. Jellicoe was engaged to deliver to the British Museum what was admittedly a dead human body, and that body was to be enclosed in a sealed case. Could any more perfect or secure method of disposing of a body be devised by the most ingenious murderer? The plan would have had only one weak point. The mummy would be known to have left Queen Square after the disappearance of John Bellingham, and suspicion might in the end have arisen. To this point I shall return presently. Meanwhile, we will consider the second hypothesis, that the missing man was made away with by Mr. Hearst. Now there seemed to be no doubt that some person, purporting to be John Bellingham, did actually visit Mr. Hearst's house, and he must have either have left the house or remained in it. If he left, he did so surreptitiously. If he remained, there could be no reasonable doubt that he had been murdered and that his body had been concealed. Let us consider the probabilities in each case. Assuming, as everyone seems to have done, that the visitor was really John Bellingham, we are dealing with a responsible middle-aged gentleman, and the idea that such a person would enter a house, announce his intention of staying, and then steal away unobserved is very difficult to accept. Moreover, he would appear to have come down to Eltham by rail immediately on landing in England, leaving his luggage in the cloakroom at Charing Cross. This pointed to a definiteness of purpose quite inconsistent with his casual disappearance from the house. On the other hand, the idea that he might have been murdered by Hearst was not inconceivable. The thing was physically possible. If Bellingham had really been in the study when Hurst came home, the murder could have been committed, by appropriate means, and the body temporarily concealed in the cupboard or elsewhere. But although possible, it was not at all probable. There was no real opportunity. The risk and the subsequent difficulties would be very great. There was not a particle of positive evidence that a murder had occurred, and the conduct of Hurst in immediately leaving the house in possession of the servants is quite inconsistent with the supposition that there was a body concealed in it. So that, while it is almost impossible to believe that John Bellingham left the house of his own accord, it is equally difficult to believe that he did not leave it. But there is a third possibility, which, strange to say, no one seems to have suggested. Supposing that the visitor was not John Bellingham at all, but someone who was impersonating him. That would dispose of the difficulties completely. The strange disappearance ceases to be strange, for a personator would necessarily make off before Mr. Hurst should arrive and discover the imposture. But if we accept this supposition, we raise two further questions. Who was the personator, and what was the object of the personation? Now, the personator was clearly not Hurst himself, for he would have been recognized by his housemaid. He was, therefore, either Godfrey Bellingham or Mr. Jellicoe or some other person, and as no other person was mentioned in the newspaper reports, I confine my speculations to these two. And first, as to Godfrey Bellingham. It did not appear whether he was or was not known to the housemaid, so I assumed, wrongly as it turns out, that he was not. Then he might have been the personator. But why should he have personated his brother? He could not have already committed the murder. There had not been time enough. He would have had to leave Woodford before John Bellingham had set out for Charing Cross. And even if he had committed the murder, he would have no object in raising this commotion. His cue would have been to remain quiet and know nothing. The probabilities were all against the personator being Godfrey Bellingham. Then could it be Mr. Jellicoe? The answer to this question is contained in the answer to the further question, what could have been the object of the personation? What motive could this unknown person have had in appearing, announcing himself as John Bellingham, and forthwith vanishing? There could only have been one motive, that namely of fixing the date of John Bellingham's disappearance, of furnishing a definite moment at which he was last seen alive. But who was likely to have had such a motive? Let us see. I said just now that if Mr. Jellicoe had murdered John Bellingham and disposed of the body in the mummy case, he would have been absolutely safe for the time being. But there would be a weak spot in his armor. For a month or more, the disappearance of his client would occasion no remark. But presently, when he failed to return, inquiries would be set on foot, and then it would appear that no one had seen him since he left Queen Square. Then it would be noted that the last person with whom he was seen was Mr. Jellicoe. It might further be remembered that the mummy had been delivered to the museum some time after the missing man was last seen alive. And so suspicion might arise and be followed by disastrous investigations. But supposing it should be made to appear that John Bellingham had been seen alive more than a month after his interview with Mr. Jellicoe, and some weeks after the mummy had been deposited in the museum. Then Mr. Jellicoe would cease to be in any way connected with the disappearance and henceforth would be absolutely safe. Hence, after carefully considering this part of the newspaper report, I came to the conclusion that the mysterious occurrence at Mr. Hurst's house had only one reasonable explanation, namely that the visitor was not John Bellingham, but someone personating him, and that that someone was Mr. Jellicoe. It remains to consider the case of Godfrey Bellingham and his daughter, though I cannot understand how any sane person can have seriously suspected either. Here Inspector Badger smiled a sour smile. The evidence against them was negligible, for there was nothing to connect them with the affair save the finding of the scarab on their premises, and that event, which might have been highly suspicious under other circumstances, was robbed of any significance by the fact that the scarab was found on a spot which had been passed a few minutes previously by the other suspected party, Hurst. The finding of the scarab did, however, establish two important conclusions, namely that John Bellingham had probably met with foul play, and that of the four persons present when it was found, one at least had had possession of the body. As to which of the four was the one, the circumstances furnished only a hint, which was this. If the scarab had been purposely dropped, the most likely person to find it was the one who dropped it, and the person who discovered it was Mr. Jellicoe. Following up this hint, if we ask ourselves what motive Mr. Jellicoe could have had for dropping it, assuming him to be the murderer, the answer is obvious. It would not be his policy to fix the crime in any particular person, but rather to set up a complication of conflicting evidence which would occupy the attention of investigators and divert it from himself. Of course, if Hearst had been the murderer, he would have had a sufficient motive for dropping the scarab, so that the case against Mr. Jellicoe was not conclusive, but the fact that it was he who found it was highly significant. This completes the analysis of the evidence contained in the original newspaper report describing the circumstances of the disappearance. The conclusions that followed from it were, as you will have seen, 1. That the missing man was almost certainly dead, as proved by the finding of the scarab after his disappearance. 2. That he had probably been murdered by one or more of four persons, as proved by the finding of the scarab on the premises, occupied by two of them and accessible to the others. 3. That of those four persons, one, Mr. Jellicoe, was the last person who was known to have been in the company of the missing man, had had an exceptional opportunity for committing the murder, and was known to have delivered a dead body to the museum subsequently to the disappearance. 4. That the supposition that Mr. Jellicoe had committed the murder rendered all the other circumstances of the disappearance clearly intelligible, whereas on any other supposition they were quite inexplicable. The evidence of the newspaper report, therefore, clearly pointed to the probability that John Bellingham had been murdered by Mr. Jellicoe and his body concealed in the mummy case. I do not wish to give you the impression that I, then and there, believed that Mr. Jellicoe was the murderer. I did not. There was no reason to suppose that the report contained all the essential facts, and I merely considered it speculatively as a study in probabilities. But I did decide that that was the only probable conclusion from the facts that were given. Nearly 2 years had passed before I heard anything more of the case. Then it was brought to my notice by my friend Dr. Berkeley, and I became acquainted with certain new facts, which I will consider in the order in which they became known to me. The first new light on the case came from the will. As soon as I had read the document, I felt convinced that there was something wrong. The testator's evident intention was that his brother should inherit the property, whereas the construction of the will was such as almost certainly to defeat that intention. The devolution of the property depended on the burial clause, clause 2, but the burial arrangement would ordinarily be decided by the executor, who happened to be Mr. Jellicoe. Thus, the will left the disposition of the property under the control of Mr. Jellicoe, though his action could have been contested. Now, this will, although drawn up by John Bellingham, was executed in Mr. Jellicoe's office, as is proved by the fact that it was witnessed by two of his clerks. He was the testator's lawyer, and it was his duty to insist on the will being properly drawn. Evidently, he did nothing of the kind, and this fact strongly suggested some kind of collusion on his part with Hearst, who stood to benefit by the miscarriage of the will. And this was the odd feature in the case, for whereas the party responsible for the defective provisions was Mr. Jellicoe, the party who benefited was Hearst. But the most startling peculiarity of the will was the way in which it fitted the circumstances of the disappearance. It looked as if Clause 2 had been drawn up with those very circumstances in view. Since, however, the will was 10 years old, this was impossible. But if Clause 2 could not have been devised to fit the disappearance, could the disappearance not have been devised to fit Clause 2? That was by no means impossible. Under the circumstances, it looked rather probable. And if it had been so contrived, who was the agent in that contrivance? Hearst stood to benefit, but there was no evidence that he even knew the contents of the will. There only remained Mr. Jellicoe, who had certainly connived at the misdrawing of the will for some purpose of his own, some dishonest purpose. The evidence of the will, then, pointed to Mr. Jellicoe as the agent in the disappearance, and after reading it I definitely suspected him of the crime. Suspicion, however, is one thing and proof is another. I had not nearly enough evidence to justify me in laying in information, and I could not approach the museum officials without making a definite accusation. The great difficulty of the case was that I could discover no motive. I could not see any way in which Mr. Jellicoe would benefit by the disappearance. His own legacy was secure, whenever and however the testator died. The murder and the concealment apparently benefited Hearst alone, and in the absence of any plausible motive, the facts required to be much more conclusive than they were. "Did you form absolutely no opinion as to motive?" asked Mr. Jellicoe. He put the question in a quiet, passionless tone, as if he were discussing some cause célèbre in which he had nothing more than a professional interest. Indeed, the calm, impersonal interest that he displayed in Thorndyke's analysis, his unmoved attention, punctuated by little nods of approval at each telling point in the argument, were the most surprising features of this astounding interview. "I did form an opinion," replied Thorndyke, "but it was merely speculative, and I was never able to confirm it. I discovered that about 10 years ago Mr. Hearst had been in difficulties and that he had suddenly raised a considerable sum of money. No one knew how or on what security. I observed that this even coincided with the execution of the will, and I surmised that there might be some connection between them. But that was only a surmise, and, as the proverb has it, he discovers who proves. I could prove nothing, so that I never discovered Mr. Jellicoe's motive, and I don't know it now." "Don't you really?" said Mr. Jellicoe, in something approaching a tone of animation. He laid down the end of his cigarette, and as he selected another from the silver case, he continued, "I think that is the most interesting feature of your really remarkable analysis. It does give you great credit. The absence of motive would have appeared to most persons a fatal objection to the theory of what I may call the prosecution. Permit me to congratulate you on the consistency and tenacity with which you have pursued the actual visible facts." He bowed stiffly to Thorndyke, who returned his bow with equal stiffness, lighted a fresh cigarette, and once more leaned back in his chair with the calm, attentive manner of a man who is listening to a lecture or a musical performance. "The evidence, then, being insufficient to act upon," Thorndyke resumed, "there was nothing for it but to wait for some new facts. Now, the study of a large series of carefully conducted murders brings into view an almost invariable phenomenon. The cautious murderer, in his anxiety to make himself secure, does too much, and it is this excessive precaution that leads to detection. It happens constantly, indeed I may say that it always happens, in those murders that are detected, of those that are not we say nothing, and I had strong hopes that it would happen in this case, and it did. At the very moment when my client's case seemed most hopeless, some human remains were discovered at Sidcup. I read the account of the discovery in the evening paper, and scanty as the report was, it recorded enough facts to convince me that the inevitable mistake had been made." "Did it indeed?" said Mr. Jellicoe. "A mere inexpert hearsay report? I should have supposed it to be quite valueless from a scientific point of view." "So it was," said Thorndyke. "But it gave the date of the discovery and the locality, and it also mentioned what bones had been found, which were all vital facts. Take the question of time. These remains, after lying perdu for 2 years, suddenly come to light just as the parties, who have also been lying perdu, had begun to take action in respect of the will, in fact within a week or two of the hearing of the application. It was certainly a remarkable coincidence. And when the circumstances that occasioned the discovery were considered, the coincidence became more remarkable still. For these remains were found on land actually belonging to John Bellingham, and their discovery resulted from the certain operations, the clearing of the watercress beds, carried out on behalf of the absent landlord. But by whose orders were those works undertaken? Clearly by the orders of the landlord's agent. But the landlord's agent was known to be Mr. Jellicoe. Therefore, these remains were brought to light at this peculiarly opportune moment by the action of Mr. Jellicoe. The coincidence, I say again, was very remarkable. But what instantly arrested my attention on reading the newspaper report was the unusual manner in which the arm had been separated, for besides the bones of the arm proper, there were those of what anatomists call the shoulder girdle, the shoulder blade and collarbone. This was very remarkable. It seemed to suggest a knowledge of anatomy, and yet no murderer, even if he possessed such knowledge, would make a display of it on such an occasion. It seemed to me that there must be some other explanation. Accordingly, when other remains had come to light, and all had been collected at Woodford, I asked my friend Berkeley to go down there and inspect them. He did so, and this is what he found. Both arms had been detached in the same peculiar manner, both were complete, and all the bones were from the same body. The bones were quite clean, of soft structures, I mean. There were no cuts, scratches, or marks on them. There was not a trace of adipocere, the peculiar waxy soap that forms in bodies that decay in water or in a damp situation. The right hand had been detached at the time the arm was thrown into the pond, and the left ring finger had been separated and had vanished. This latter fact had attracted my attention from the first, but I will leave its consideration for the moment and return to it later.
"How did you discover that the hand had been detached?" Mr. Jellicoe asked.
"By the submergent marks," replied Thorndyke. "It was lying on the bottom of the pond in a position which would have been impossible if it had been attached to the arm."
"You interest me exceedingly," said Mr. Jellicoe.
"It appears that a medico-legal expert finds books in the running brooks, sermons in bones, and evidence in everything. But don't let me interrupt you."
"Dr. Berkeley's observations," Thorndyke resumed, "together with the medical evidence at the inquest, led me to certain conclusions. Let me state the facts which were disclosed. The remains which had been assembled formed a complete human skeleton with the exception of the skull, one finger, and the legs from the knees to the ankle, including both kneecaps. This was a very impressive fact, for the bones that were missing included all those which could have been identified as belonging or not belonging to John Bellingham, and the bones that were present were the unidentifiable remainder. It had a suspicious appearance of selection, but the parts that were present were also curiously suggestive. In all cases, the mode of dismemberment was peculiar, for an ordinary person would have divided the knee joint, leaving the kneecap attached to the thigh, whereas it had evidently been left attached to the shin bone, and the head would most probably have been removed by cutting through the neck instead of being neatly detached from the spine. And all these bones were almost entirely free from marks or scratches, such as would naturally occur in an ordinary dismemberment, and were quite free from adipocere. And now as to the conclusions which I drew from these facts. First, there was the peculiar grouping of the bones. What was the meaning of that? Well, the idea of a punctilious anatomist was obviously absurd, and I put it aside. But was there any other explanation? Yes, there was. The bones had appeared in the natural groups that are held together by ligaments, and they had separated to points where they were attached principally by muscles. The kneecap, for instance, which really belongs to the thigh, is attached to it by muscle, but to the shin bone by a stout ligament. And so with the bones of the arm, they are connected to one another by ligaments, but to the trunk only by muscle, excepting at one end of the collarbone. But this was a very significant fact. Ligament decays much more slowly than muscle, so that in a body which the muscles had largely decayed, the bones might still be held together by ligament. The peculiar grouping therefore suggested that the body had been partly reduced to a skeleton before it was dismembered, that it had been merely pulled apart and not divided with a knife. This suggestion was remarkably confirmed by the total absence of knife cuts or scratches. Then there was the fact that all the bones were quite free from adipocere. Now, if an arm or a thigh should be deposited in water and left undisturbed to decay, it is certain that large masses of adipocere would be formed. Probably more than half of the flesh would be converted into this substance. The absence of adipocere therefore proved that the bulk of the flesh had disappeared or been removed from the bones before they were deposited in the pond. That, in fact, was not a body, but a skeleton that had been deposited. But what kind of skeleton? If it was the recent skeleton of a murdered man, then the bones had been carefully stripped of flesh so as to leave the ligaments intact. But this was highly improbable, for there could be no object in preserving the ligaments, and the absence of scratches was against this view. Then they did not appear to be graveyard bones. The collection was too complete. It is very rare to find a graveyard skeleton of which many of the small bones are not missing, and such bones are usually more or less weathered and friable. They did not appear to be bones such as may be bought at an osteological dealer's, for these usually have perforations to admit the macerating fluid to the marrow cavities. Dealers' bones, too, are very seldom all from the same body, and the small bones of the hand are drilled with holes to enable them to be strung on catgut. They were not dissecting room bones, as there was no trace of red lead in the openings for the nutrient arteries.
What the appearances did suggest was that these were parts of a body which had decayed in a very dry atmosphere, in which no adipocere would be formed, and which had been pulled or broken apart. Also that the ligaments which held the body, or rather skeleton, together, were brittle and friable as suggested by the detached hand, which had probably broken off accidentally. But the only kind of a body that completely answered this description is an Egyptian mummy. A mummy, it is true, has been more or less preserved, but on exposure to the air of such a climate as ours, it perishes rapidly, the ligaments being the last of the soft parts to disappear. The hypothesis that these bones were parts of a mummy naturally suggested Mr. Jellicoe. If he had murdered John Bellingham and concealed his body in the mummy case, he would have a spare mummy on his hands, and that mummy would have been exposed to the air and to somewhat rough handling. A very interesting circumstance connected with these remains was that the ring finger was missing. Now, fingers have on sundry occasions been detached from dead hands for the sake of the rings on them, but in such cases the object has been to secure a valuable ring uninjured. If this hand was the hand of John Bellingham, there was no such object. The purpose was to prevent identification, and that purpose would have been more easily and much more completely achieved by sacrificing the ring, by filing through it or breaking it off the finger. The appearances, therefore, did not quite agree with the apparent purpose. Then could there be any other purpose with which they agreed better? Yes, there could. If it had happened that John Bellingham were known to have worn a ring on that finger, and especially if that ring fitted tightly, the removal of the finger would serve a very useful purpose. It would create an impression that the finger had been removed on account of a ring to prevent identification, which impression would, in turn, produce a suspicion that the hand was that of John Bellingham. And yet it would not be evidence that could be used to establish identity. Now, if Mr. Jellicoe were the murderer and had the body hidden elsewhere, vague suspicion would be precisely what he would desire, and positive evidence what he would wish to avoid. It transpired later that John Bellingham did wear a ring on that finger, and that the ring fitted very tightly. Whence it followed that the absence of the finger was an additional point tending to implicate Mr. Jellicoe. And now let us briefly review this mass of evidence. You will see that it consists of a multitude of items, each either trivial or speculative. Up to the time of the actual discovery, I had not a single crucial fact, nor any clue as to motive. But slight as the individual points of evidence were, they pointed with impressive unanimity to one person, Mr. Jellicoe. Thus, the person who had the opportunity to commit murder and dispose of the body was Mr. Jellicoe. The deceased was last certainly seen alive with Mr. Jellicoe. An unidentified human body was delivered to the museum by Mr. Jellicoe. The only person who could have a motive for personating the deceased was Mr. Jellicoe. The only known person who could possibly have done so was Mr. Jellicoe. One of the two persons who could have had a motive for dropping the scarab was Mr. Jellicoe. The person who found that scarab was Mr. Jellicoe, although owing to his defective eyesight and his spectacles, he was the most unlikely person of those present to find it. The person who was responsible for the execution of the defective will was Mr. Jellicoe. Then as to the remains, they were apparently not those of John Bellingham, but parts of a particular kind of body. But the only person who was known to have had such a body in his possession was Mr. Jellicoe. The only person who could have had any motive for substituting those remains for the remains of the deceased was Mr. Jellicoe. Finally, the person who caused the discovery of those remains at that singularly opportune moment was Mr. Jellicoe. This was the sum of the evidence that was in my possession up to the time of the hearing, and indeed for some time after, and it was not enough to act upon. But when the case had been heard in court, it was evident either that the proceedings would be abandoned, which was unlikely, or that there would be new developments. I watched the progress of events with profound interest. An attempt had been made, by Mr. Jellicoe or some other person, to get the will administered without producing the body of John Bellingham, and that attempt had failed. The coroner's jury had refused to identify the remains. The probate court had refused to presume the death of the testator. As affairs stood, the will could not be administered. What would be the next move? It was virtually certain that it would consist in the production of something which would identify the unrecognized remains as those of the testator. But what would that something be? The answer to that question would contain the answer to another question. Was my solution of the mystery the true solution? If I was wrong, it was possible that some of the undoubtedly genuine bones of John Bellingham might presently be discovered, for instance the skull, the kneecap, or the left fibula, by any of which the remains could be positively identified. If I was right, only one thing could possibly happen. Mr. Jellicoe would have to play the trump card that he had been holding back in case the court should refuse the application, a card that he was evidently reluctant to play. He would have to produce the bones of the mummy's finger, together with John Bellingham's ring. No other course was possible. But not only would the bones and the ring have to be found together, they would have to be found in a place which was accessible to Mr. Jellicoe, and so far under his control that he could determine the exact time when the discovery should be made. I waited patiently for the answer to my question. Was I right or was I wrong? And in due course the answer came. The bones and the ring were discovered in the well in the grounds of Godfrey Bellingham's late house. That house was the property of John Bellingham. Mr. Jellicoe was John Bellingham's agent. Hence it was practically certain that the date on which the well was emptied was settled by Mr. Jellicoe. The oracle had spoken. The discovery proved conclusively that the bones were not those of John Bellingham, for if they had been, the ring would have been unnecessary for identification. But if the bones were not John Bellingham's, the ring was, from which followed the important corollary that whoever had deposited those bones in the well had had possession of the body of John Bellingham, and there could be no doubt that that person was Mr. Jellicoe. On receiving this final confirmation of my conclusions, I applied forthwith to Dr. Norbury for permission to examine the mummy of Sebek Hotep, with the result that you are already acquainted with. As Thorndyke concluded, Mr. Jellicoe regarded him thoughtfully for a moment and then said, "You have given us a most complete and lucid exposition of your method of investigation, sir. I have enjoyed it exceedingly, and should have profited by it hereafter, under other circumstances. Are you sure you won't allow me to fill your glass?" He touched the stopper of the decanter, and Inspector Badger ostentatiously consulted his watch. "Time is running on, I fear," said Mr. Jellicoe. "It is indeed," Badger assented emphatically. "Well, I need not detain you long," said the lawyer. "My statement is a narration of events, but I desire to make it, and you no doubt will be interested to hear it." He opened the silver case and selected a fresh cigarette, which, however, he did not light. Inspector Badger produced a funereal notebook, which he laid open on his knee, and the rest of us settled ourselves in our chairs with no little curiosity to hear Mr. Jellicoe's statement. End of chapter 19. Chapter 20 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 20. The End of the Case. A profound silence had fallen on the room and its occupants. Mr. Jellicoe sat with his eyes fixed on the table as if deep in thought, the unlighted cigarette in one hand, the other grasping the tumbler of water. Presently Inspector Badger coughed impatiently and he looked up. "I beg your pardon, gentlemen," he said. "I am keeping you waiting." He took a sip from the tumbler, opened a matchbox, and took out a match, but apparently altering his mind, laid it down and commenced, "The unfortunate affair which has brought you here tonight had its origin 10 years ago. At that time my friend Hurst became suddenly involved in financial difficulties. Am I speaking too fast for you, Mr. Badger?" "No, not at all," replied Badger. "I am taking it down in shorthand." "Thank you," said Mr. Jellicoe. "He became involved in serious difficulties and came to me for assistance. He wished to borrow £5,000 to enable him to meet his engagements. I had a certain amount of money at my disposal, but I did not consider Hurst's security satisfactory. Accordingly, I felt compelled to refuse. But on the very next day, John Bellingham called on me with a draft of his will, which he wished me to look over before it was executed. It was an absurd will, and I nearly told him so, but then an idea occurred to me in connection with Hurst. It was obvious to me, as soon as I glanced through the will, that if the burial clause was left as the testator had drafted it, Hurst had a very good chance of inheriting the property, and as I was named as the executor, I should be able to give full effect to that clause. Accordingly, I asked for a few days to consider the will, and then I called upon Hurst and made a proposal to him, which was this. that I should advance him £5,000 without security, that I should ask for no repayment, but that he should assign to me any interest that he might have or acquire in the estate of John Bellingham up to £10,000, or two-thirds of any sum that he might inherit if over that amount. He asked if John had yet made any will, and I replied quite correctly that he had not. He inquired if I knew what testamentary arrangements John intended to make, and again I answered quite correctly that I believed John proposed to devise the bulk of his property to his brother Godfrey. Thereupon Hurst accepted my proposal. I made him the advance, and he executed the assignment. After a few days' delay, I passed the will as satisfactory. The actual document was written from the draft by the testator himself, and a fortnight after Hurst had executed the assignment, John signed the will in my office. By the provision of that will, I stood an excellent chance of becoming virtually the principal beneficiary, unless Godfrey should contest Hurst's claim and the court should override the conditions of Clause 2. You will now understand the motives which governed my subsequent actions. You will also see, Dr. Thorndyke, how very near to the truth your reasoning carried you, and you will understand, as I wish you to do, that Mr. Hurst was no party to any of these proceedings which I am about to describe. Coming now to the interview in Queen Square in October, 1902, you are aware of the general circumstances from my evidence in court, which was literally correct up to a certain point. The interview took place in a room on the third floor, in which were stored the cases which John had brought with him from Egypt. The mummy was unpacked, as were some other objects that he was not offering to the museum, but several cases were still unopened. At the conclusion of the interview, I accompanied Dr. Norbury down to the street door, and we stood on the doorstep conversing for perhaps a quarter of an hour. Then Dr. Norbury went away and I returned upstairs. Now the house in Queen Square is virtually a museum. The upper part is separated from the lower by a massive door which opens from the hall and gives access to the staircase, and which is fitted with a Chubb night latch. There are two latch keys, of which John used to keep one and I the other. You will find them both in the safe behind me. The caretaker had no key and no access to the upper part of the house unless admitted by one of us. At the time when I came in, after Dr. Norbury had left, the caretaker was in the cellar where I could hear him breaking coke for the hot water furnace. I had left John on the third floor opening some of the packing cases by the light of a lamp with a tool somewhat like a plasterer's hammer. That is, a hammer with a small axe blade at the reverse of the head. As I stood talking to Dr. Norbury, I could hear him knocking out the nails and wrenching up the lids, and when I entered the doorway leading to the stairs, I could still hear him. Just as I closed the staircase door behind me, I heard a rumbling noise from above, then all was still. I went up the stairs to the second floor, where, as the staircase was all in darkness, I stopped to light the gas. As I turned to ascend the next flight, I saw a hand projecting over the edge of the halfway landing. I ran up the stairs, and there on the landing, I saw John lying huddled up in a heap at the foot of the top flight. There was a wound at the side of his forehead from which a little blood was trickling. The case opener lay on the floor close by him, and there was blood on the axe blade. When I looked up the stairs, I saw a rag of torn matting over the top stair. It was quite easy to see what had happened. He had walked quickly out on the landing with the case opener in his hand. His foot had caught in the torn matting, and he had pitched head foremost down the stairs, still holding the case opener. He had fallen so that his head had come down on the upturned edge of the axe blade. He had then rolled over, and the case opener had dropped from his hand. I lit a wax match and stooped down to look at him. His head was in a very peculiar position, which made me suspect that his neck was broken. There was extremely little bleeding from the wound. He was perfectly motionless. I could detect no sign of breathing, and I felt no doubt that he was dead. It was an exceedingly regrettable affair, and it placed me, as I perceived at once, in an extremely awkward position. My first impulse was to send the caretaker for a doctor and a policeman, but a moment's reflection convinced me that there were serious objections to this course. There was nothing to show that I had not myself knocked him down with a case opener. Of course, there was nothing to show that I had. But we were alone in the house with the exception of the caretaker, who was down in the basement out of earshot. There would be an inquest. At the inquest, inquiries would be made as to the will which was known to exist. But as soon as the will was produced, Hurst would become suspicious. He would probably make a statement to the coroner and I should be charged with the murder. Or even if I were not charged, Hurst would suspect me and would probably repudiate the assignment, and under the circumstances, it would be practically impossible for me to enforce it. He would refuse to pay and I could not take my claim into court. I sat down on the stairs just above poor John's body and considered the matter in detail. At the worst, I stood a fair chance of hanging. At the best, I stood to lose close upon £50,000. These were not pleasant alternatives. Supposing, on the other hand, I concealed the body and gave out that John had gone to Paris. There was, of course, the risk of discovery, in which case I should certainly be convicted of the murder. But if no discovery occurred, I was not only safe from suspicion, but I secured the £50,000. In either case, there were considerable risk, but in one there was the certainty of loss, whereas in the other there was a material advantage to justify the risk. The question was whether it would be possible to conceal the body. If it were, then the contingent profit was worth the slight additional risk. But a human body is a very difficult thing to dispose of, especially by a person of so little scientific culture as myself. It is curious that I considered this question for a quite considerable time before the obvious solution presented itself. I turned over at least a dozen methods of disposing of the body, and rejected them all as impracticable. Then suddenly I remembered the mummy upstairs. At first it only occurred to me as a fantastic possibility that I could conceal the body in the mummy case. But as I turned over the idea, I began to see that it was really practicable, and not only practicable, but easy, and not only easy, but eminently safe. If once the mummy case was in the museum, I was rid of it forever. The circumstances were, as you, sir, have justly observed, singularly favorable. There would be no hue and cry, no hurry, no anxiety, but ample time for all the necessary preparations. Then the mummy case itself was curiously suitable. Its length was ample, as I knew from having measured it. It was a cartonnage of rather flexible material and had an opening behind, secured with a lacing so that it could be opened without injury. Nothing need be cut but the lacing, which could be replaced. A little damage might be done in extracting the mummy and in introducing the deceased, but such cracks as might occur would be of no importance. For here again fortune favored me. The whole of the back of the mummy case was coated with bitumen, and it would be easy when once the deceased was safely inside to apply a fresh coat, which would cover up not only the cracks but also the new lacing. After careful consideration, I decided to adopt the plan. I went downstairs and sent the caretaker on an errand to the law courts. Then I returned and carried the deceased up to one of the third-floor rooms, where I removed his clothes and laid him out on a long packing case in the position in which he would lie in the mummy case. I folded his clothes neatly and packed them, with the exception of his boots, in a suitcase that he had been taking to Paris and which contained nothing but his nightclothes, toilet articles, and change of linen. By the time I had done this and thoroughly washed the oilcloth on the stairs and landing, the caretaker had returned. I informed him that Mr. Bellingham had started for Paris and that I went home. The upper part of the house was of course secured by the Chubb lock, but I had also, ex abuntia catule, locked the door of the room in which I had deposited the deceased. I had of course some knowledge of the methods of embalming, but principally of those employed by the ancients. Hence, on the following day, I went to the British Museum Library and consulted the most recent works on the subject, and exceedingly interesting they were, as showing the remarkable improvements that modern knowledge has effected in this ancient art. I need not trouble you with details that are familiar to you. The process that I selected as the simplest for a beginner was that of formalin injection, and I went straight from the museum to purchase the necessary materials. I did not, however, buy an embalming syringe. The book stated that an ordinary anatomical injecting syringe would answer the same purpose, and I thought it a more discreet purchase. I fear that I bungled the injection terribly, although I had carefully studied the plates in a treatise on anatomy, Gray's, I think. However, if my methods were clumsy, they were quite effectual. I carried out the process on the evening of the third day, and when I locked up the house that night, I had the satisfaction of knowing that poor John's remains were secure from corruption and decay. But this was not enough. The great weight of a fresh body as compared with that of a mummy would be immediately noticed by those who had the handling of the mummy case. Moreover, the damp from the body would quickly ruin the cartonnage and would cause a steamy film on the inside of the glass case in which it would be exhibited, and this would probably lead to an examination. Clearly, then, it was necessary that the remains of the deceased should be thoroughly dried before they were enclosed in the cartonnage. Here, my unfortunate deficiency in scientific knowledge was a great drawback. I had no idea how this result would be achieved, and in the end was compelled to consult a taxidermist, to whom I represented that I wished to collect some small animals and reptiles, and rapidly dry them for convenience of transport. By this person I was advised to immerse the dead animals in a jar of methylated spirit for a week, and then expose them in a current of warm, dry air. But the plan of immersing the remains of the deceased in a jar of methylated spirit was obviously impracticable. However, I bethought me that we had in our collection a porphyry sarcophagus, the cavity of which had been shaped to receive a small mummy in its case. I tried the deceased in the sarcophagus and found that he just fitted the cavity loosely. I obtained a few gallons of methylated spirit, which I poured into the cavity, just covering the body, and then I put on the lid and luted it down airtight with putty. I trust I do not weary you with these particulars. "I'll ask you to cut it as short as you can, Mr. Jellicoe," said Badger. "It has been a long yarn, and time is running on." "For my part," said Thorndyke, "I find these details deeply interesting and instructive. They fill in the outline that I had drawn by inference." "Precisely," said Mr. Jellicoe. "Then I will proceed." I left the deceased soaking in the spirit for a fortnight, and then took him out, wiped him dry, and laid him on four cane-bottom chairs just over the hot water pipes, and I let a free current of air pass through the room. The result interested me exceedingly. By the end of the third day, the hands and feet had become quite dry and shriveled and horny, so that the ring actually dropped off the shrunken finger, the nose looked like a fold of parchment, and the skin of the body was so dry and smooth that you could have engrossed a lease on it. For the first day or two, I turned the deceased at intervals so that he should dry evenly, and then I proceeded to get the case ready. I divided the lacing and extracted the mummy with great care as to the case, I mean, for the mummy suffered some injury in the extraction. It was very badly embalmed, and so brittle that it broke in several places while I was getting it out, and when I unrolled it, the head separated and both the arms came off. On the sixth day after the removal from the sarcophagus, I took the bandages that I had removed from Sebek Hotep and very carefully wrapped the deceased in them, sprinkling powdered myrrh and gum benzoin freely on the body and between the folds of the wrappings to disguise the faint odor of the spirit and the formalin that still lingered about the body. When the wrappings had been applied, the deceased really had a most workmanlike appearance. He would have looked quite well in a glass case even without the cartonnage, and I felt almost regretful at having to put him out of sight forever. It was a difficult business getting him into the case without assistance, and I cracked the cartonnage badly in several places before he was safely enclosed. But I got him in at last, and then, when I had closed up the case with new lacing, I applied a fresh layer of bitumen which effectually covered up the cracks on the new cord. A dusty cloth dabbed over the bitumen when it was dried disguised its newness, and the cartonnage with its tenant was ready for delivery. I notified Dr. Norbury of the fact, and 5 days later he came and removed it to the museum. Now that the main difficulty was disposed of, I began to consider the further difficulty to which you, sir, have alluded with such admirable perspicuity. It was necessary that John Bellingham should make one more appearance in public before sinking into final oblivion. Accordingly, I devised the visit to Hearst House, which was calculated to serve two purposes. It created a satisfactory date for the disappearance, eliminating me from any connection with it, and by throwing some suspicion on Hearst, it would make him more amenable, less likely to dispute my claim when he learned the provisions of the will. The affair was quite simple. I knew that Hearst had changed his servants since I was last at his house, and I knew his habits. On that day I took the suitcase to Charing Cross and deposited it in the cloakroom, called at Hearst's office to make sure that he was there, and went from thence direct to Cannon Street and caught the train to Eltham. On arriving at the house, I took the precaution to remove my spectacles, the only distinctive feature of my exterior, and was duly shown into the study at my request. As soon as the housemaid had left the room, I quietly let myself out by the French window, which I closed behind me but could not fasten, went out at the side gate and closed it also behind me, holding the bolt of the latch back with my pocket knife so that I need not slam the gate to shut it. The other events of that day, including the dropping of the scarab, I need not describe, as they are known to you. But I may fitly make a few remarks on the unfortunate tactical error in which I fell in respect of the bones. That error arose, as you have doubtless perceived, from the lawyer's incurable habit of underestimating the scientific expert. I had no idea mere bones were capable of furnishing so much information to a man of science. The way in which the affair came about was this. The damaged mummy of Sebek Hotep, perishing gradually by exposure to the air, was not only an eyesore to me, it was a definite danger. It was the only remaining link between me and the disappearance. I resolved to be rid of it and cast about for some means of destroying it. And then, in an evil moment, the idea of utilizing it occurred to me. There was an undoubted danger that the court might refuse to presume death after so short an interval, and if the permission should be postponed, the will might never be administered during my lifetime. Hence, if these bones of Sebek Hotep could be made to simulate the remains of the deceased testator, a definite good would be achieved. But I knew that the entire skeleton could never be mistaken for his. The deceased had broken his kneecaps and damaged his ankle, injuries which I assumed would leave some permanent trace. But if a judicious selection of the bones were deposited in a suitable place, together with some object clearly identifiable as appertaining to the deceased, it seemed to me that the difficulty would be met. I need not trouble you with the details. The course which I adopted is known to you, with the attendant circumstances, even the accidental detachment of the right hand, which broke off as I was packing the arm in my handbag. Erroneous as that course was, it would have been successful but for the unforeseen contingency of your being retained in the case. Thus, for nearly 2 years, I remained in complete security. From time to time I dropped in at the museum to see if the deceased was keeping in good condition, and on those occasions I used to reflect with satisfaction on the gratifying circumstance, accidental though it was, that his wishes, as expressed very imperfectly in clause 2, had been fully complied with, and that without prejudice to my interests. The awakening came on that evening when I saw you at the temple gate talking with Dr. Berkeley. I suspected immediately that something was gone amiss and that it was too late to take any useful action. Since then I have waited here in hourly expectation of this visit, and now the time has come. You have made the winning move, and it remains only for me to pay my debts like an honest gambler. He paused and quietly lit his cigarette. Inspector Badger yawned and put away his notebook. "Have you done, Mr. Jellicoe?" the inspector asked. "I want to carry out my contract to the letter, you know, though it's getting devilish late." Mr. Jellicoe took a cigarette from his mouth and drank a glass of water. "I forgot to ask," he said, "whether you unrolled the mummy, if I may apply the term to the imperfectly treated remains of my deceased client." "I did not open the mummy case," replied Thorndyke.
"You did not!" exclaimed Mr. Jellicoe. "Then how did you verify your suspicions?"
"I took an X-ray photograph."
"Ah, indeed!" Mr. Jellicoe pondered for some moments. "Astonishing," he murmured, "and most ingenious. The resources of science at the present day are truly wonderful."
"Is there anything more that you want to say?" asked Badger. "Because if you don't, time's up."
"Anything more?" Mr. Jellicoe repeated slowly.
"Anything more?" "No, I think the time is up. Yes, the time." He broke off and sat with a strange look fixed on Thorndyke. His face had suddenly undergone a curious change. It looked shrunken and cadaverous, and his lips had assumed a peculiar cherry-red color.
"Is anything the matter, Mr. Jellicoe?" Badger asked uneasily. "Are you not feeling well, sir?"
Mr. Jellicoe did not appear to have heard the question, for he returned no answer, but sat motionless, leaning back in his chair, with his hands spread out on the table and a strangely intent gaze bent on Thorndyke. Suddenly his head dropped on his breast, and his body seemed to collapse, and as with one accord we sprang to our feet, he slid forward off his chair and disappeared under the table.
"Good Lord, the man's fainted!" exclaimed Badger. In a moment he was down on his hands and knees, trembling with excitement, groping under the table. He dragged the unconscious lawyer out into the light and knelt over him, staring into his face. "What's the matter with him, doctor?" he asked, looking up at Thorndyke. "Is it apoplexy, or is it a heart attack, think you?"
Thorndyke shook his head, though he stooped and put his fingers on the unconscious man's wrist.
"Prussic acid or potassium cyanide is what the appearances suggest," he replied. "But can't you do anything?" demanded the inspector.
Thorndyke dropped the arm, which fell limply to the floor.
"You can't do much for a dead man," he said. "Dead? Then he has slipped through our fingers after all."
"He has anticipated the sentence, that is all," Thorndyke spoke in an even, impassive tone which struck me as rather strange, considering the suddenness of the tragedy, as did also the complete absence of surprise in his manner. He seemed to treat the occurrence as a perfectly natural one.
Not so Inspector Badger, who rose to his feet and stood with his hands thrust into his pockets, scowling sullenly down at the dead lawyer.
"I was an infernal fool to agree to his blasted conditions," he growled savagely.
"Nonsense," said Thorndyke. "If you had broken in, you would have found the dead man. As it was, you found a live man and obtained an important statement. You acted quite properly."
"How do you suppose he managed it?" asked Badger.
Thorndyke held out his hand.
"Let us look at his cigarette case," said he.
Badger extracted the little silver case from the dead man's pocket and opened it. There were 5 cigarettes in it, 2 of which were plain, while the other 3 were gold-tipped. Thorndyke took out one of each kind and gently pinched their ends. The gold-tipped one he returned, the plain one he tore through, about a quarter of an inch from the end, when 2 little black tabloids dropped out onto the table. Badger eagerly picked one up and was about to smell it when Thorndyke grasped his wrist.
"Be careful," said he,
and when he had cautiously sniffed at the tabloid, held it a safe distance from his nose, he added,
"Yes, potassium cyanide."
"I thought so when his lips turned that queer color. It was in the last cigarette. You can see that he has bitten the end off." For some time we stood silently looking down at the still form stretched on the floor. Presently Badger looked up. "As you pass the porter's lodge on your way out," said he, "you might just drop in and tell him to send a constable to me."
"Very well," said Thorndyke. "And by the way, Badger, you had better tip that sherry back into the decanter and put it under lock and key, or else pour it out of the window." "Gad, yes," exclaimed the inspector. "I'm glad you mentioned it. We might have had an inquest on a constable as well as a lawyer. Good night, gentlemen, if you are off."
We went out and left him with his prisoner, passive enough indeed, according to his ambiguously worded promise. As we passed through the gateway, Thorndyke gave the inspector's message, curtly and without comment, to the gaping porter, and then we issued forth into Chancery Lane. We were all silent and very grave, and I thought that Thorndyke seemed somewhat moved. Perhaps Mr. Jellicoe's last intent look, which I suspect he knew to be the look of a dying man, lingered in his memory as it did in mine. Halfway down Chancery Lane he spoke for the first time, and then it was only to ejaculate, "Poor devil!"
Jervis took him up. "He was a consummate villain, Thorndyke."
"Hardly that," was the reply. "I should rather say that he was non-moral. He acted without malice and without scruple or remorse. His conduct exhibited a passionless expediency which was dreadful because utterly unhuman. But he was a strong man, a courageous, self-contained man, and I had been better pleased if it could have been ordained that some other hand than mine should let the axe fall." Thorndyke's compunction may appear strange and inconsistent, but yet his feeling was also my own. Great as was the misery and suffering that this inscrutable man had brought into the lives of those I loved, I forgave him, and in his downfall forgot the callous restlessness with which he had pursued his evil purpose. For it was he who had brought Ruth into my life, who had opened for me the paradise of love into which I had just entered. And so my thoughts turned away from the still shape that lay on the floor of the stately old room in Lincoln's Inn, away to the sunny vista of the future, where I should walk hand in hand with Ruth until my time too should come, until I too, like the grim lawyer, should hear the solemn evening bell bidding me put out into the darkness of the silent sea. End of chapter 20.
End of the Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. TNCs apply. In-app only.